So I guess we'll start with a review of the four types of people that we've talked about so far that the Proverbs looks at. And we're actually not going to get into the book of Proverbs this morning. We're mostly going to look at some other texts. But one of the statements made in week one was that each one of us is presumably somewhat to very wise in one or more areas of life and yet really needs wisdom in another area of life. The challenge is not only to recognize the areas where you need wisdom, but then in light of what we're going to look at right now, where do you fall in terms of your understanding of that need for wisdom? So we say the simple person just doesn't know. They don't know that they don't know. They either haven't had the life experience to make them aware that there's things that they don't know, or they're like your adolescent child who says that you're worrying too much about their future, or that the bad thing that happened to somebody down the road could never happen to them. So the simple-minded cannot project themselves into situations. So to be, we'll say, unsimple requires a degree of creativity. Creativity that can allow me to see myself in various circumstances and say, could I get into that situation? What would be my response in that situation? The simple person simply doesn't think about that at all. Followed by the foolish. The foolish is a person who knows enough to think that they know it all. So if we were to write or draw an illustration of this, it's one I've used a lot, but if you were to draw a circle on the backside of your paper, I guess that would mean that you'd need a pen to do that, right? Does everybody have a pen? Does anybody need a handout? Okay. So if you were to draw a circle on the back of your paper, oh, you don't have a back to your paper. There's print on the back of your paper. And let everything in that side, that circle, represent your knowledge, what you're aware of in life. Let the perimeter of the circle then represent all that stuff in life that you've had contact with and you know that you don't know. What happens as the circle diminishes in size? In other words, if we were to say that a person starts out with a very small circle, everything inside the circle represents what they know. The perimeter of the circle represents the boundary between what they know and what they don't know, but what they are aware that they don't know. Describe the relationship. You would hope that the circle would grow, but what is the dynamic that is taking place between the size of the circle and the awareness? As your circle, remember, everything inside the circle represents what you already know. The less you know, the smaller the perimeter. Which means the less you know, the less you know that you don't know. The greater your circle of knowledge, the greater you know, and the more that you are aware of that you don't know. Therefore, the wisest person in the room is the person who knows what? Well, he doesn't know the least, but he is keenly aware of how little he knows compared to all that is to be known. So if we say the simple person knows very little, then what's their exposure to what they don't know? There's an almost infinite amount that they don't know that they don't know. But the foolish person goes it one better. They assume that the circle can only grow so large and that they've already grown the circle to the size that it can be grown. And therefore, there is nothing more to be learned. Now, this applies to almost everything in life, but it's why, incidentally, you will, generally speaking, if a person is both humble and well-educated, And usually well-educated people are humble because they become aware of this. And they'll usually not be so dogmatic and certain about what they know. Have you ever been sure of something when you were 30 and by the time you're 40 you find out that there's exceptions to that? And by the time you're 50, you've had to deconstruct and then reconstruct everything that you thought you knew. And so now you know that there's not only exceptions to what you know that some of what you know might even not be valid information. And so the larger the body of understanding that you have, the greater your contact with what you don't know. All right, we move on to the third category of people, the wicked. So the foolish person scoffs at the idea that other people might have useful information. The wicked person, in the Proverbs, scoffs at something different. He or she scoffs at the idea that there's consequences, or that God sees, or that God cares about their behaviors, or that there even is a God. So there's scoffers in both of those categories, the foolish and the wicked. It's just the difference in what they laugh at. So as you read through the book of Proverbs, you're going to see times where a scoffer is referenced to. You have to determine then at that point in time, is this person a scoffer who is laughing at the idea that there's more to learn? Or are they a scoffer that thinks that there's no consequence for them? And then finally, there's the wise person. The Jewish people have an interesting custom that nobody else seems to have in quite the same way, and it's the the process of bar mitzvah or bat mitzvahing someone. Anybody know anything about that? Yeah. No. Okay. Well, yes, they are. They're a man at 13, or they're a woman at 13, but what does that mean to them? Okay. The term actually means, bar means son, bat means daughter, and it means to be a son or a daughter under the covenant or responsible for keeping the covenant. So we'll call that the age of accountability in the mind of a Jewish person. That at the age of 13, an individual becomes a young man or a young woman, their parents are no longer responsible to God for their behavior. The boy or the girl, now the man or the woman, is personally accountable to God for his behavior. And here's the interesting thing. He becomes an adult member of Jewish society at that age. Well, we know a lot of 12 and 13 year olds, right? Would you say that they're fit to be adults in all the ways that... No, they're certainly not, are they? But there is an interesting understanding here that we can learn from. When you think of a 12 or a 13-year-old, what do you think of? Someone who has a lot less to learn, huh? But what if you thought of a 12 or a 13-year-old, as these people do, or as many primitive tribes do, as someone who is entering adulthood and needs to be equipped for that task? What if instead of assuming that a 12 or a 13-year-old was simply a kid with lots left to learn, we assume that a 12 or a 13-year-old could be equipped to make many wise decisions and would be accountable to God for those decisions, and therefore, we as the adult community, and in fact their parents or whatever, were instilling into them from the earliest age possible the things that would equip them to make those decisions instead of allowing them to sit there and play video games all day? What if it was our mission in life not to make the next generation happy, but to make the next generation wise? Would that change the way culture looked at all, do you think?
Yeah.
And so I think they're on to something that we could learn from them. As a matter of fact, that is what should happen here. Since none of those people are here right now, think about this. What do we do when we have a youth program in a church? We make a lot of it about fun. We make it as interesting and engaging as possible. But we separate it from making the big choices that adults have to make. Now, in their custom, the 12-year-old or the 13-year-old boy would sit with the 50-year-olds and the 60-year-olds. What would he hear whenever they discuss things? the big topics of the day discussed in adult-like fashion. You know, as I've read a number of biographies, what I've noticed, and I've shared this with y'all before, is that there's a group of people that describe that in their house growing up, when they were children growing up, that they don't remember the television being on a lot. They don't remember being sent off to another room to play games. They remember, even as young children, sitting on the floor and playing while their parents were at the kitchen table, we'll say, having adult conversations. And they remember over a period of time this transition that took place where they became less fascinated with whatever they were playing with and more interested in at least listening in on the adult conversations that were taking place. And then at a certain point in time, given the permission of their parents, they started to ask the adults questions. Or maybe even offered up a solution or at least a suggestion for what they might do. And in that way, they were sort of like apprentice adults. Could we do that? I mean, it would certainly take a revolution in the way we think about adolescence, wouldn't it? Let's turn over to Deuteronomy 11. Keep this, what we've just talked about, in mind as we're reading through this, and we're going to have to, unfortunately, read through most of this chapter. You shall therefore love the Lord your God and keep His charge, His statutes, His rules, His commandments, always. Maybe we should do a brief introduction to Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy is delivered, the words are delivered toward the end of Moses' life. You know that they're during the last, we'll say, 5 years of his life before the gang is going to cross over the Jordan River and occupy the land that they've been promised and have been wandering around and waiting to get to for the last 40 years. And so Moses, toward the end of his life, delivers this collection of, we'll call them, public speeches, during which he reminds the people of what God has done for them in the past. He reminds them of the commitment that they made to obey and to follow God, and he reminds them of the challenges of doing that. And it says toward the tail end of what we call this book that he actually repens a lot of the laws. That he takes not the ceremonial laws, not the things that the priests were concerned with, not how to sacrifice animals or any of that, but the day-to-day responsibilities of the people. How they're to live for God, how they're to treat their neighbor, how they're to treat the alien or the foreigner, as it's often called, how they're to treat each other and even the people that they don't like. And he takes those concepts and he repens them into something that he hopes that they're going to remember. So imagine that you had a terminal illness and you didn't have long, and there were things that you were pretty convinced that your family didn't yet know or grasp at the level that you wanted them to. And imagine that you were pretty confident that if they didn't get a hold of these concepts and start to live by them, that everything that you had worked your life for might unravel. That you wanted to set them up for success, you wanted to set them up for prosperity, you wanted to know that your life mattered, because if everything that they did fell apart in 10 years, then your life didn't really count for that much after all anyway. What are some of the things that you would want to tell your family then? That's what Moses sets out to do. And so undoubtedly, there might have been assemblies, and he couldn't say everything at once, or maybe they couldn't bear to hear more than so much at a time. Maybe they needed time to think about what they'd heard. And so they'd be called back again from time to time, and he would deliver more. And so now we'll pick up again. You shall therefore love the Lord your God, keep His charge, His statutes, His rules, His commands, always, and consider today, since I'm not speaking to your children who have not known or seen, consider the discipline of the Lord your God, His greatness, His mighty hand, His outstretched arms, His signs, and His deeds that He did in Egypt, to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and to all the land. Now here's what we know. God had said to the people many years before, when they refused to go take the land when they had the opportunity, and He said to them, fine, If you don't trust me enough to go into the land, and this was after only several months of being in the wilderness, if you don't trust me enough, if you think that the people in the land are giants, if you're afraid to enter the land, then you can't enter the land. If you do not trust me, then this generation that has rejected my leadership can wander around in the desert for the next 40 years until all of a certain age or above have died off. That's one way to get rid of the bad stock, is just allow them to wander around until they all die. So when Moses is talking to this group of people and he says, well, you remember, or you... It's a funny phrase, because actually there shouldn't be that many people living anymore that do remember. And so what we have to assume is that some of these are the adult sons and daughters. The exploits of God, the miracles in Egypt, all this stuff has been transferred to them. It's been talked about on a regular basis. And so Moses is talking to a generation who grew up with, we'll say, secondhand information about this. But it's still fresh. As a matter of fact, when they lived in their tents in the desert, mom and dad might have had some things that still came from Egypt. So when the young child asked, well, where did that come from? Oh, that was from this. Or as I was leaving Egypt... And it says that as the people were leaving Egypt, the Egyptians wanted them out so desperately by this time. Because remember, Pharaoh had wealth, Pharaoh had power. So the wealthy people have the best opportunity to resist difficult times, right? It was the poor people of Egypt who suffered the most under the plagues. And so it was the people who had the least who were willing to give up even that and give it to the Israelites on their way out of the land and say, just take all this and be gone. So it says the Israelites had some of that. So then the children that they have, they have questions. Well, where did this come from? Oh, that's interesting. How did you get that? And there's all these conversations, and every single conversation, it says, and we're going to see this in a minute, has the chance to lead to a conversation about God, how God has interacted with their lives up to that point in time. All right. And what he did to the army of Egypt, to their horses and their chariots, and how he made the water of the Red Sea flow over them as he pursued after them. And how the Lord has destroyed them to this day. And what he did to you in the wilderness until you came to this place. And what he did to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eli. And there was a revolution, actually, and I don't have much time to talk about that. But about midway through this 40-year point in time, a group of people rose up and there was going to be a mutiny. He said to Moses, what makes you so special that you should lead us? Who are you to lead us? And why is it that you think that all of the power and the authority resides with you? Which of course it didn't. And the scriptures say that Moses falls on his face before the people and he pleads to God and he says, tomorrow I want you to assemble yourselves and we'll let God show all of us who he's elected, who he's chosen to lead. By the next day, it says the people are starting to have second thoughts. So the leaders of this upstart mutiny don't even want to show up for the assembly. Now, why is that? They've just told Moses, they've just questioned Moses in front of all the people. It says there's about 250 leaders who rise up together, and each one of them represents a clan. So there might be thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people represented by these 250 people. This is not a small thing. Now, what would make them, only 24 hours after they had called Moses out and said, who are you? What would make them not even show up to find out? Oh, maybe they're afraid that after all that Moses is the chosen leader, and what's going to happen to them if they show up for the assembly and God rejects them. So that's what's being talked about there. All right, jump down to verse 8. You shall therefore keep the whole commandment that I command you today, that you may be strong and go in to take possession of the land that you're going over to possess, and that you may live long in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give to them and their offspring. Jump down to 13. And if you will obey my commands that I commanded you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your hearts and with all of your souls, he will give the rain to your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain and your wine and your oil. Here's what Moses is saying. We look at this and we think, okay, if I obey God, God gives me all the good stuff, therefore I'll obey God. Why? To get the good stuff. I don't obey God because I really care about God. I obey God because I get, again, the good stuff. So when I obey God, I get the good stuff. When I don't obey God, I get the bad stuff. But that's, unfortunately, not quite the way this is supposed to be understood. Instead, what it's saying is, God has chosen, and this is the language if we look at the body of text, not just this verse. From all of the people in the whole earth, God has chosen you to be in special relationship with you. And not only has He chosen you, but He's picked a place for you to live. So imagine, if you will, a new husband, and the husband takes the bride whom he loves dearly and takes her and sets up a gorgeous home for her. And says, I'd like you to just care for this home in this way. And primarily what I want you to do is I want your affections to be for me for the rest of your life. Now, why does God have to tell the people that they need to keep obeying? Because already, we might want to say they're still in the dating phase, right? They haven't even really gotten serious about this relationship. They haven't even moved into their first house. They haven't, Scott, accumulated all the stuff that they'll later have to throw away. They haven't even gotten that far in life. They haven't even moved into their starter home, and God is already having to instruct them because the people have eyes for other gods. And He will give grass in your fields and for your livestock, and you shall eat and be full. Take care lest your hearts be deceived and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and He will shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain, and the land will yield no fruit, and you will perish quickly off the good land that the Lord is giving you. Well, that's a pretty interesting promise. Okay, they haven't even gotten into the land. Moses was not a great inspirational speaker. Because here's in essence what he says. If you obey God, things are going to go well for you. But I want to tell you right now, before you ever get there, that you're going to die quickly if you do not obey the Lord your God. Because what does it say? It says, you will perish quickly off the good land that the Lord is giving you. You shall therefore lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and you shall bind them as signs on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. All right, so stop before we move on there. One of the big deals about being bar mitzvahed is that the parents of this young man or young woman get to buy the child who will be an adult these little boxes of scripture that they can wrap around their head for Shabbat service, and these little things that wrap around their arm that contain scripture. Exactly the same thing, and here's the idea. At this point in time, you need reminders. You are personally, from this day forward, accountable to God for your behavior, and you need reminders of that on a regular basis. Let's make it practical. I want you to think about the day. This was the one day during the week when you actually woke up and you read a little scripture before you left. Right? We hear all the time about how men don't read all that much, or they don't regularly invest in exploring the scriptures. So let's say that you, before you leave, you spend 15, 20 minutes, you digest some scripture, you think about what it means, you jump in your car, you go to work. How long does it take before you've forgotten what you read? The first heated discussion at work? The first guy who cuts you off in traffic? Whatever it is, pick. How long does it take before everything that you have promised to God only a few hours before is just distant history? And we're going to get into more of this, but he says, here's the best way for you to remember the kind of people that you're supposed to be. Create for yourself ways to have this stuff visually in front of you. Not a whole book of, or a scroll of scripture, but instead little reminders. And look at this. And you shall teach them to your children, talking of them when you are sitting in your home, and when you are walking by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall write them in the doorposts of your house and on your gates, that your days and the days of your children may be multiplied in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give them. For those of us with children of our own, here's an interesting question. What if you were personally responsible to make sure that your kids had the wisdom that they needed to live for God well? And that if you didn't do your job as a father well, that your kids might go in a very bad direction. Would it change the way you parented if every day you asked the question, what is the wisdom that my children need to hear today that will help to inform the collective body of understanding that they have about how to live for God? That was a mouthful, wasn't it? Yeah, you probably wouldn't ask yourself that every day. But I want us to pause for a moment before we go on and think about the miracle of becoming an adult human being. Now think about this. How much does a newborn baby know? The brains are already starting to process things that are happening in the womb. Right? There's a reasonable body of evidence that suggests that they hear things, that they understand things, that there's some small things that they're able to perceive. So some information is already in them the moment they're born. How long do we assume that it takes for a person to become an adult? Usually, in terms of their understanding. Forget the Jewish idea for a moment. 18, 20, 25? 30. 30? Well, Ron. Here's the thing. They say that the male brain is not fully matured physically. In other words, it's not a full brain until about the age of 25. In other words, all the connections, all the information. There was a twitching of the eye there. Does that mean you're not mature yet or what?
Yeah, a couple years.
25 before all of the hardware is fully assembled. Now that's just the hardware. That doesn't mean there's any good data in there. It just means that the hardware is fully functional at about the age of 25. Now you're an exceptionally bright fellow, so we're going to give you the benefit of the doubt. And we'll scale that back and say maybe it's 23 for you. I don't know. Now, here's the next interesting thing. Having done some studies on men, what they found is that a man is not what we'll call emotionally mature until he's somewhere into his early to mid-40s. That's depressing. That he doesn't know what to do with his feelings. He doesn't know how to balance the difference between what he knows and what he doesn't know, what other people think of him, what he thinks of himself. He doesn't know how to fuse all of this into something and manage his emotions well until he's sometime into his 40s. Who decides what goes into us? This is a powerful question. Who decides what goes into us? Because what goes into us is what we become. Now, I know this sounds like something trivial to talk about, but I really want you to meditate on that this week. Are we the product of a number of just random exposures to things, or did somebody have an actual and intentional plan for what we would be exposed to? So we all know that there's certain physical things that children, by nature of their very curiosity, will acquire. Most kids learn how to walk. Why? Because the ball is over there, and they want to get to the ball, and they need to figure a way to get to the ball. But we've talked about this before. How long does it take for a child just to learn to walk? Something as simple as learning to walk. I have a grandson who's like 3, I think. Yeah, I think he's about that age. He has a really lively conversation with people, but you can't understand one word that he says in 50. Every once in a while, there's some individual word that you can pick out, but for the most part, I have no idea what the kid is saying. So I'll look at my son, his father, and say, "What's he saying?" He says, "I have no idea." Well, that's reassuring in some ways because it means it's not only me. We were just doing this the other night. I went over, and my older grandson is old enough that I used to say to my wife, "Give me kids when they're about 6 or 7. They start to be fun then. Before that, they're sort of like, oh, never mind. It will only go bad for me if I go down this road further. But it's like by the time kids are 6 or 7 or 8, they start to be fun. So I'm over there doing something with my older grandson, and the younger one, who is the we'll call him babbling idiot, who doesn't know how to say anything that I understand, just decides to climb up on my lap. Listen, I didn't say I was a good father, did I? No, I did not. And he just sits there while we're playing this game, the older one and I. And he's pointing at stuff and going on in his yammerish way and all this stuff. Come back to the question. Who decides what goes into them, and how long does it take to develop an adult out of the raw material that is a human being? In this culture, at this time, who did God think was most responsible for making that happen? In this order, the family and then the community. The family and then the community. Everything that you will learn about what it means to be an adult, you will learn in your home. And then what you don't learn in your home, because you can't learn everything, you will learn out in society. What does that mean? It means that society is the guardian of each child that comes into its presence. As we look out in the world around us, would you say that society views itself as the guardian of every child that comes into its presence? Maybe, maybe not. Let's read this one more time. You shall teach them to your children, talking of them when you are sitting in your house, and when you are walking by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Are there tangible reminders in your home of the way you want to live? Now, I don't mean the kind of thing that you go to the Christian bookstore and buy, and there's this nicely framed verse that hangs on the wall. Are there other tangible reminders? Are there little things in your home that remind you of the great things that God has done in the past? Maybe it's a rock, maybe it's a piece of wood, maybe it's something. And to anybody else, it doesn't mean a thing. But to you, it's priceless because it's a piece of, or it represents something that. It's a piece of the history that you and God have together. Let's turn over to Numbers 15. Now, this is exciting because it's not every day that people go to the book of Numbers and read something. To Numbers 15, we're going to start at verse 27. If one person sins unintentionally, he shall offer a female goat, a year old, for a sin offering. And the priest shall make atonement before the Lord for the person who makes a mistake when he sins unintentionally, to make atonement for him. And he, meaning the person who sinned accidentally, will be forgiven. You shall have one law for him who does anything unintentionally, for him who is native among the people of Israel, and for the stranger who sojourns among you. In other words, in the entire land, there's not supposed to be these double standards. If you're of one race, if you're of one creed, if you're of one this, if you're... There is a single standard. If a person makes a mistake, then there's a certain kind of offering that's to be given. But the person who does anything with a high hand, which means they know it's wrong, and they're going to do it anyway. But the person who does anything with a high hand, whether he is a native or a sojourner, reviles the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among his people, because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment. That person shall be utterly cut off. his iniquity shall be on him. That's really harsh. Why such harsh statements? And it doesn't seem as if it's, listen, if the person does something 15 times, on the 16th time, that's it. It says instead, when the person knows the difference between right and wrong, and they go and they do the wrong anyway, according to all these things that God has said are right and wrong, that person is to be, what's the phrase? Cut off. What does that mean? Why? Well, come on. You're part of the mature male community here at Morningstar. Why?
The thing of Peter is tough. You know, when you make one bad decision, it's tough for anyone to trust you. It's hard to regain your quote unquote security in the community or family.
Remember what we've talked about children? Children get their exposure, their experience, or at least at that time, from two basic sources, from the family and then from the community. What happens if there is a person in your community? Have you ever noticed that children are pretty observant? Right? They don't miss much. Matter of fact, sometimes they see the stuff that you and I have seen so often we don't even pay any attention to it anymore. The kid notices it. What happens when the kid notices that Joe just completely violated something that's a clear command of God and nobody does anything? What's the kid learn?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. There really aren't consequences after all.
It's the next time here.
Now, imagine that playing out multiple times. What do you think happens two or three generations out?
See what's going on today and there.
Now, there you go getting political again.
Just saying.
Now, here's the interesting thing. When we read the Proverbs, you see a lot of that. You see, whether it's Solomon or whether it's David or some of this, and the Proverbs are acquired wisdom, some of it may have even come from other cultures, and it's all been assembled because it's all good, solid, godly wisdom. And you see statements about how certain people say, God doesn't notice, God doesn't care. You see that in the Psalms. I've done good, God doesn't notice. That guy's done bad, God doesn't notice. When we don't respond to the behaviors of other people in society, then other people notice. And exactly like Ron said, well, then I guess it doesn't really matter all that much after all. It's not really a big deal. All right, now it's going to get really tough. Verse 32. While the people of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation. And they put him in custody because it had not been made clear what should be done to him. And the "it had not been made clear" means God has not in any way communicated with Moses and given Moses a sense of what should happen. And then the Lord said to Moses, "The man shall be put to death. All of the congregation shall stone him and stone him outside the camp." And all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones as the Lord God commanded Moses. What had the guy done? Gather some firewood, right? He wasn't out there cleaning his lawn. It wasn't that kind of sticks. It wasn't, boy, the hurricane just came through and there's these pesky branches in my lawn. No, the guy was out gathering sticks to make a fire. Fires weren't even allowed on the Sabbath, incidentally. You weren't supposed to cook. You were supposed to prepare all the food that you would eat on the Sabbath the day before so that you didn't have to prepare a meal on the Sabbath. Now, I know a lot of these commands seem cumbersome and burdensome. When I was preparing for this and reading some of the bar mitzvah stuff, it really settled in on me what they were expecting of a 13-year-old young man. He had to have a grasp of God's commandments, and there were a lot of them. He had to understand why God expected certain things. He was to have been immersed in this for years leading up to this. It was a really big deal. And so when the guy goes out and he gathers sticks to build a fire, and the people bring him to Moses, and look at the punishment. What's the punishment? Have you ever asked yourself, what's the deal with stones? No, I mean, really, can you imagine? Have you, or worse yet, and maybe now's a good time to do this, have you ever placed yourself in the position of the person being stoned? Please give me a good sharp sword and a block of wood. I will put my neck down on that block of wood. You can swing your sword and it will all be done. But do not pick up golf balls and kill me with them. Do you realize how long that's going to take? How painful it's going to be. Why the command to stone people? It seems barbaric. Let's just be honest. It seems like a just God, a loving God, would never allow that to happen. Why the command? Remember, you are the adult community here at Morning Star. You are the wise men of Morning Star. So you should understand this. Your brain isn't developed yet. It's okay for you. That's part of the reason. But there's another more powerful reason. I want you to place yourself now. Okay. First, you were the person that's going to be stoned to death. Maybe you have to be tied up first. You have to be in some way restrained so that you don't just run away. Or maybe the crowd is surrounding you and you can't get away. Do you remember Jesus' words when the people, the Pharisees, were about to stone a woman caught in adultery? What does he say? The first stone. There it is. The first stone. It's fresh, unmarred flesh. I know this sounds barbaric, but this would have happened. Who wants to be the one to cast the first stone? And what are the thoughts going through your mind when you cast the first stone? Suppose this guy was your neighbor. Suppose only 2 or 3 weeks before, he helped you get your ox out of the ditch. Remember, that was the command of one neighbor to another. Suppose he was the guy who came over and helped your wife when you had to leave and go out of town for some important business. There's the rock in your hand. And you're going to cast that stone. What does it make you think about? I never want to be in that position. What does it make you think about your own life? At the moment when you're ready to hurl the stone, you're thinking, I've probably had some bad thoughts. You might even be thinking, heck, I was just out in my backyard gathering sticks the other night, but nobody found out. You see, it brings the whole community into this sense of sin. And the sin in this case was simply, it wasn't that, well, gathering sticks doesn't have universal consequences. I mean, I've gathered sticks. The world hasn't come to a stop. The earth doesn't tilt a different way on its axis. Gathering sticks doesn't seem to be all that bad. But it was an unfaithfulness to God and His covenant and what God asked the people to do. We judge it today and we think, this is horrendous. And given grace and given the fact that Jesus has paid the price, we don't have to throw stones at each other. But if you place yourself in this time and in this place and you think what it would feel like to cast the first stone, to cast the 31st stone is not a big deal. To cast the first stone would be gut-wrenching and agonizing. And the Lord said to Moses, speak to the people of Israel and tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a cord of blue on the tassel of each corner. Have you ever been to New York City, or maybe one of the suburbs in Connecticut or some other place where there are Orthodox Jews living abundantly? I think in is it Lakeside, New Jersey, there's a large community. And admittedly, they look a little unusual in their dress, right? They stand out. The strange hats, the weird haircuts, the somewhat unusual clothes. And here again, look at what God is saying. Speak to the people of Israel and tell them to make tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a cord of blue on the tassels of each corner. And it shall be a tassel for you to look at and to remember all the commands of the Lord to do them, not to follow after your own heart or your own eyes, which you were inclined to whore after. Well, that's some pretty graphic language there. What's he saying? Do you remember what one of our key verses was last week? In those days, finish it for me. In those days, there was no... In Israel. Israel. The right word is Israel. There was no king in Israel. Okay. And therefore, what happened? Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That was the Ron Myers translation, which is reasonably close to most of the others. Yes, did as he wished. So you shall remember to do all the commands and be holy to your God, and to not, what? Follow your own heart and your own eyes, which you are inclined to whore after. So what is God saying is the natural tendency of every human being? God speaking through Moses. What is he saying? Every one of us has this predisposition to go after what we want, the way that we want. And so what does God say to him? Make up these tassels. Now that's a weird clothing thing. And I'm not encouraging you to go home and sew tassels on the corners of your t-shirts. Please don't. Or if you do, don't come back here, because we don't want your weirdness here in our community. But what is he saying? Anybody? What is it that would be a constant reminder? Where are you most tempted to go astray? And I don't mean with some, we'll say, outmoded and somewhat out-of-date Jewish laws, some of which don't even remotely apply to us today. Most of us would go to a seafood restaurant and eat some shellfish, right? We wouldn't have to repent in sackcloth and ashes for the next 5 years because we ate some shellfish. So admittedly, there's some weird customs that we don't need to worry about anymore. But what are the universals that God says, do this or don't do that, that you need to have a reminder at a critical moment? Do you need a tassel on the key ring of your car? I do. Do you need a reminder of some sort at work? Do you need something in your home? Are you tempted to go astray in your own home? Maybe it's your computer. Maybe you need a tassel on your computer. And there's two colors of tassels. So first off, let's talk about tassels. Because it's more than clothing. What is it? Well, you know what the people wore? They wore not a whole lot, right? They wore, right? You had to make your clothes. It's hard work. The average person is not wealthy. Remember what one of the commandments was? At the end of the day, if you have taken your neighbor's cloak as security for something that you loaned him, in other words, you loaned him some money, so you took his coat in exchange for it, what was that? That was collateral to make sure that you got your money back. What were you to do at the end of the day? If you had his cloak as security for a debt, what were you to do? Anybody? You were to give it back to him because it's the only blanket that he would have to sleep for the night, and you didn't want him to get cold. So clothing was a big deal, and most people didn't have lots of extra clothing. So why go to the trouble when you hardly have anything to begin with to sew stuff on the corners of this limited amount of clothing? Because at that time, clothing was a sign of wealth, and tassels on the clothing was a sign of significance and nobility. And so to sew, I'll be right with you, and to sew tassels on the corners of your clothing was to remind you that you were a noble individual, and noble individuals didn't stoop to this way of reasoning and behaving. And then, in the midst of all the tassels, you notice this? A blue cord. Everything associated with the temple had some blue in it. The priest's garments, the temple curtain. Blue was a regal color, just like purple. And so mixed among the tassels that would remind you that you were a noble person was one colored tassel that reminded that you were not only noble, but that you were a priest, you were a representative of God, you were a chosen priesthood of people. Bill.
Is that what today the tassels from graduation ceremonies and stuff, that's symbolic?
You know, I don't have any idea. That's a good question. Bill, you have brought me the perimeter of my knowledge, and I have been exposed to my ignorance.
Again.
Bill, did you say again? I need a tassel right now, lest I do something that I would later regret. And so he wraps it up with this: so you shall remember to do all of my commandments and be holy to your God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. And so again, all this stuff is in light of the relationship that God wants with us. And there are things that facilitate the relationship, and there are things that detract from it. So in light of everything that we've just talked about, what are some of the things that you might need to go home and implement in your own life? And I've actually been giving some thought to this. So I'm sure most of you know this. We meaning the people that work with me, we make decals, and a lot of the decals that we make are safety decals that go on the sides of equipment. A couple of the girls that have worked in our office have joked over the years about, have you ever seen the little decals and somebody's got their hand stuck in something and there's pieces of finger flying off this way and that way. Some of the really graphic ones actually have little red spots or squirts, like where blood is coming out of the fingers. And then there's other ones where some guy has got his head smashed in, and then there's other ones where, like on these big brush chippers that, you know, take whole trees and grind them up and spit them out into mulch, and you'll see some guy, and really pretty graphic. I mean, somebody took a lot of time to have this guy with his hand going into the feed mill, and there's pieces of the guy flying out the other end. I mean, there's some pretty odd stuff. And so we would have these couple of jokes. The first one was, oh, there's that poor guy again, and he just never seems to have the sense to stay out of anything. Because they're always stick-figure guys, and so they always look the same. But then for a moment, we'd get serious. We'd say, you know, the reason that this decal had to be created by the manufacturer is probably because there is an initial story of somebody who didn't know enough not to do this. They were the guy under the thing. They were the guy with his hand caught in the thing. They were the guy that was impaled by the thing. And the reason over a period of time that manufacturers have developed these specific decals is because stupid people did stupid things at certain times and they needed a reminder not to do the things. So I come back and I ask us all this question, and I want it to be personal. What are the reminders that you need in every area of your life where you could be challenged to go pick up sticks, not a kid's game in this case, a reference to that, and you need something to remind you you're not the kind of person who does that? Let's turn over to James, the first chapter. And this week, when you go home, when you start to think about where you might... And I really want you to do this. You know, it doesn't do any good for you to come here and be part of a learning community and then go home and forget everything that you just learned. If what you're learning doesn't give you the opportunity to make some tweaks or adjustments in your life, then the only benefit to being here is donuts. And that's a pretty questionable benefit, especially to wake up early on a Saturday morning for. So three kinds of wisdom that you want. You want wisdom for the things that you want to do. I need reminders in my life that remind me of the things that I should do. God has said I should do this. I should behave in this way. I should go and address that need. I should look after the widow and the fatherless. I should love my neighbor. I should even love my enemy. There are things that I need to do. Then there's another whole body of behaviors and attitudes that I want to avoid. Don't do this. And so you need tassels or reminders of one way to remind you of what you should do. You need ones that are going to remind you of what you shouldn't do. And then exactly like these decals that I was just describing, there's a whole other collection that are simply notices. It says caution or advisory. And it means that there is some potential danger here. It's not that you shouldn't do the thing, but that you should be aware that there are risks to doing it and you should be on high alert. Are there areas where you need to be on high alert? You have to do this thing, or you should do this thing, or there's actually opportunity in doing this thing, but there is also danger that could come to you as a result of doing it. All right, so let's think of a practical example. Let's say that you have the opportunity to be in some leadership position. And every time in the past that you have been exposed to people who are leaders, you found them to be phony, or you found them to be self-serving, or you found them to be something negative. Now, is leadership undesirable? Is leadership bad? Do we not need leaders? The answer is no. So we're not saying that the opportunity opens itself up to become a leader in something. Doesn't mean don't do it. By all means, take advantage of the opportunity. But are there additional hazards to being in a leadership position? And so if you were to design a special custom-created safety decal, which I'm not going to do and bring in for you, but if you were to do that, it might say, caution. Leadership influence may stroke your ego and make you think that you're more than you really are. Leadership may call you into certain relationships that could put you in compromising situations. Make sure that your life is squeaky clean. Whatever it is. So it's not a don't do, it's not a do, it's a when in these circumstances use extra caution. Okay, James, the first chapter. We will start at the second verse. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. I want to stop on that phrase for a moment. The testing of your faith produces steadfastness. What is your faith? What you believe to be true? Yes. Can we elaborate on that? Incidentally, I think that here's what I have done. I have taught all of you that if you remain silent long enough, that I will give you the answer. And you know what? I have taught you well, because most of you remain silent until I do give the answer. It is the body of knowledge that you have, both those things that have tangible evidence and those that don't, and it's not only what you believe to be true, it's also what? How you live out what you believe to be true. So let's insert that. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of what you believe to be true, those things that you believe that you know, the testing of this produces steadfastness. All right, what is steadfastness?
Perseverance.
It's also a furthering of the conviction. So if what you believe to be true is put to the test and it crumples, what should you do with that?
Throw it out, throw it over.
Right. One of two things has happened. It's either revealed that you have no steadfastness, that you are weak in the quality of character that allows you to persevere. It's either revealed that, or it's revealed that what you have staked your whole life on isn't worthy of staking your life on. It's bad faith. So he says, when these things come, don't go out and look for them. Don't shove your hand into the thing that chops it up and spits it out. Don't do that. But if bad things come into your life, difficult things come into your life, hard things come into your life, don't run from them. Stay in them in an honorable way and allow them to reveal to you things that you didn't know about yourself and you can find out in no other way. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith and with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. And that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is double-minded and unstable in all his ways. Is that part of what we just read before, or is that something different? Is there a connection?
Because when you go out,
okay.
So, double-minded.
I think whenever things don't go exactly as planned, doubt creeps in, and that can be a cancer, which you start questioning everything after that, and then before long, you totally turn your back on what you originally believed on because you don't have any substance to stand on.
Remember, we're talking and we're tying what we looked at already to this. And we're going to see how it ties in more as we get further into this. I come to a situation where my resolve is being tested, what I believe is on the line, and it's starting to reveal to me whether what I believe is right or not, and it's also starting to show me how far I am committed to go on behalf of what I say I believe. And I come to the end of myself, and so I need wisdom. Do you remember Jesus' prayer in the garden? He says, Father, this is your plan. I know this is your plan. So he has spent months in advance telling his closest followers, the day is coming. I'm going to be taken and I'm going to be killed. The day is coming. And yet he gets to the garden moment, and what does he pray? Father, I know this is your will, but if there is any other way for this to happen, let it be so. Now you can check that out for yourself. So what's Jesus doing? He's in the middle of a trial. Right? Would you agree? And he's deciding, he's committed to it, but he's also asking for wisdom. He's saying, is there another way for this to happen? Could there be something else that could happen? Give me eyes to see an alternative if an alternative exists. Now, if the alternative doesn't exist, I'll continue on. But look at what James says. But don't expect you're going to get an answer if you're not of sound and resolved mind. Why? You could get an answer and you still wouldn't know it was an answer. All right? So, an example, okay? You're having a rough patch with your wife. You That's a surprise. I know Scott was shocked at that. Scott, there are actually people in their married lives that have difficult times. You know, rumor has it there are actually people who occasionally have heated disagreements with their wives. Yeah, I know that's a surprise, but this has happened already. I read about it once in a book. No personal experience with it, but I've read about it once in a book. Well, anyway, suppose that this rough patch with your wife went on for maybe a year or two. There was just a lot of issues that were coming up, and they weren't easy to resolve, and you and your wife were at odds with each other. And you're seeking wisdom about what to do with this. Now, suppose at the same time, an old love shows up in town. You haven't seen her in 15 years. And 15 years have not weathered her significantly, let's just put it that way. She looked good 15 years ago. She's not so hard on the eyes today. And she likes you. She meets up with you at a place, I don't know, you run into each other at the local Wawa, and you strike up an informal conversation. Now, the person who is double-minded, who's not sure exactly what he wants out of life, may say to himself, and haven't we all heard people say something like this, I wonder if this is a sign. I wonder if this is something coming into my life at the right time, because it's clear that this, my wife is not right for me anymore, and here's this other woman who could be right for me. I wonder if this is not God giving me another start in life. Now, would you say that's good godly wisdom? No, of course not. But if you're not already of stable mind, you might interpret the information the wrong way. And so what the prayer is here is, God, help me to have your wisdom, your eyes, to see if there is a way out. Now, God has already provided the answer for the guy and his wife and then the old flame at the Wawa. And what's the answer? When you can make a commitment, a covenant relationship with a woman, it's for life. You don't need more wisdom about that. You might need wisdom about how to go through the day-to-day things, but you don't need new revelation to tell you, no, you stay where you are. Let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation, and the rich in his humiliation. So here we are, and James has either got a really severe case of ADD, where he just flits from one thing to another, and he can't seem to keep his mind on things, or there's something more going on. So he's first talked about testing of his faith and whether we're steadfast. Then he's talked about asking for wisdom. And now he comes to this, let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation and the rich in his humiliation, because like the flowers of the grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the grass, its flower falls, and its beauty perishes. So also will the rich man fade away in the midst of his pursuits. What does that have to do with what we just read? I mean, he doesn't even look, a good writer, a good speaker kind of like gives a summary. So if he was done with the point before, he should have wrapped it up with a good, interesting sentence, a closing sentence, and then moved on to the next thing, being derisive toward rich people, if that's in fact what he's doing. But what if that's not what he's doing? What else could he be saying here? Have you ever said to yourself, I wish I had more money, because if I had more money, I could just fix the problem that way? Have you ever been working along with an older car and you said, if I just had a spare 40 grand, I'd go buy myself a new truck and this problem wouldn't exist anymore? Have you ever thought that? Well, maybe it was a new car, maybe you didn't fancy a new truck, I don't know, whatever it was. Have you ever just thought, if I had more money, the problems would all just go away? Now, in light of that, is it possible that what he's saying is, listen, don't allow your tangible resources to give you a way out by buying your way out of everything, or you will never learn to go through a trial. Look at how he introduces it. Let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation. The guy who was nothing has now been called up to the front lines where he can take a stand for God. and the rich in his humiliation. And you, if you have money, you've been brought to the front lines where your money shouldn't buy you any special privilege. And so James says, both rich and poor can choose to go through the same trial in an honorable way. Don't you dare take resources and just throw them at the problem so that you never have to experience any pain in life. Because look at what he says, for the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the grass, and its flower falls, and its beauty perishes. So also will the rich man fade away in the midst of his pursuits. Now he is not condemning rich people. What he is condemning is a mentality that says, when you take your money and make all your problems go away with money and insulate yourself with money on every occasion, do you ever build up any internal character? Do you ever allow yourself to go through anything? And so a person of no internal substance does what? Fades away in the midst of his pursuits. Now, money is not the only thing. Maybe it's influence. Maybe it's power. Maybe it's the people you know that can get you out of difficult situations. What he's saying is, whenever you have wealth of any type, whether it's financial, whether it's relational, whether it's anything, and you try to buy your way out of problems, could Jesus have gotten out of going to the cross? Yeah. He could have sidestepped the trial, the persecution. See, I've already bored one person to the point that he leaves. He came for the donuts, he came for the coffee. Hey, have a good day. Come back to verse 12 here. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. So there it is. It's just gotten knit together. We've gone from counted a joy when you have trials to asking God in the trials for wisdom to not using what we'll call unfair advantage to get out of trials. This is blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love Him. Let no one say that he is, when he is tempted, that I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and He Himself tempts no one. That seems an odd thing to introduce there. But we all hear that. There's a lot of even scripture that, not carefully interpreted, would suggest that God brings these kinds of things to us. What would happen in a man's life? Why does James need to say this? What would happen in a man's life if he assumed that God was tempting him? In light of what we've already looked at, in light of what we just read, what would happen in a man's life if he assumed that God was the one that was tempting him? Are you going to go to God for wisdom when you think God is the one who's bringing the difficulty into your life? Here's the way it looks. What does James call this? He calls it a test. How do we understand tests? So we get some lessons in life, right? And then we'll say this is in a classroom. We're taught some things, and then the teacher hands out a test, right? How many of you went to the teacher and said, I don't know this. Can you tell me what the answer is? During the test. Right? Who does that? No one goes to the teacher who's administering the test and says, tell me what the answer is. And so what James is saying is, if you assume that God is the one who is sending the difficulties into your life, then you're probably going to have a distance between you and God that's going to prevent you from going to Him for wisdom. You need to understand that God is on your side. The test is on this side. You and God can be here. If you put God over there on that side with the test, then God becomes almost your adversary, not your ally. So don't assume that God is the one bringing the test. Assume that you and God are the allies, and together you are going to overcome the test. But instead, let's look at what's happening here. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and He tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured away and enticed by his own desire. It's interesting, it doesn't even say it's an evil desire. It's a very neutral term. It's just desire. Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. So if you have a margin there in the notes and you want to write something, or if actually if you have room in your Bible, you might want to write, desire meets opportunity. So opportunity is the thing outside your life. Desire is the thing inside your life. So let's come back to... got control of that now, Bill?
Yeah,
all right. Do we need to tie a tassel to the chair to remind you that... Let's come back to the guy who meets the hot young babe at the Wawa. Or, well, she's older now, but hasn't seen her in 15 years. You know what? Let's not lead any of us into temptation, okay? All right. Here's what I've learned. Inside, they're all women, right? So 5 minutes after you get to know any of them, they all think the same, so it doesn't matter. You may as well stay with the one you've got. Can we move on now, Scott? Okay. So, desire and opportunity. So, the woman at the Wawa shows up. What does that show you? It reveals to you what's going on inside of you already. And so here's the way James describes it. Let's read the entire thing here. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. So the desire, the thing that would compel you, lives inside of you. Let's look at this in light of the trial, the difficult thing that you're going through. What would be the desire inside of you during the difficulty? Come on. How can I get out of this stupid difficulty? Wouldn't that be desire? And that's why it's not called an evil desire. Is there anything wrong with wanting to get out of the difficulty? Not at all. It's choosing how to get out of the difficulty. So James already addressed one of the ways that you could get out of the difficulty. You could just buy your way out of it. You could influence your way out of it. You could bribe your way out of it if you had the money to do so. There's any one of a number of ways that if you had additional influence, you could get out of that. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. And then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth. Well, there has to be something there for it to conceive with. And that's opportunity. And so here's how, if we were to rephrase this, we might say it. When desire and opportunity meet, they go out and they have a wild one-night stand. And what do they bring? What's the result of that? It gives birth to sin. Let me pause for a moment. It's in your notes here, top of the backside. Wisdom warns us of fatal attractions, which are those affections we develop which soon have us in their power. Or as Tim Keller puts it, lust isn't only wanting bad things, it's also wanting things badly. Have you ever wanted a good thing, but you wanted it so much that it almost took control of you? See, we tend to think of trials as the really difficult things that come into our life, but what if a trial is wanting something good but allowing the good desire that you have to get so out of control that it takes hold in your life? See, for us today, the danger isn't that we replace God with idols of wood or stone or whatever. The danger is that we replace God with the desires that we have in our own life that get so out of control and we can't keep them under control. And we let them take us to places, almost drag us to places that we wouldn't otherwise go. So desire and opportunity meet, they have a one-night stand. They produce this thing inside of us. Now what do we do with that? Now, I'm not talking about this being a real one-night stand and you've been unfaithful to your wife. But have you ever had a one-night stand with something? Have you ever pursued a desire and pursued it beyond what you should have? Has the opportunity ever presented itself and you've gone out after something and you weren't quite sure if you should, but you took the easy way out, you took the fun way out, you took the whatever it was way out? What do you do with that? Well, what do most people do when they have an affair? They go home the following day and say, "Honey, you'll never guess what I did last night." What do they do?
Hide.
Yeah, you bet they do. Now, I want it to be graphic so that it sticks with us. Do we have affairs of the heart and, as it were, cheat on God and think we can somehow hide it from God? Do we let things start to consume us in ways that are unhealthy, and pretty soon the desires got taken a hold of us? Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. How does an addict become an addict? Is it the first time? The first time becomes a second time. And the second time becomes a third time. And the third time becomes, well, let's see what else there is out there. Our hearts are not led astray by a single event. Usually our hearts are led astray because we allow the single event to influence us. And so what's the caution decal that we would put on desire meets opportunity? There's danger ahead. Don't think that you are above this. How many functional alcoholics say, "I've got a handle on this"? All of them, yes. Do they have a handle on it?
No.
It's easy to see it in that case, right? Can I be a functional money-holic? Whatever it is, can I be incomplete on the inside and need the approval of other people and start to do things just to get the approval of other people? And now once I'm hooked on that, now what happens when I'm asked to compromise my relationship with God in order to do something? Because that's what I need to do to get the approval of other people. See, the first time I get the approval of other people and I put that in front of something else, maybe it's not all that dangerous. Maybe it's not even dangerous the third or the fourth time. It's what happens after the 10th or the 15th time when that's set up to be my nature. And sin is no longer an infant that I can kill. Sin has become an adolescent. It's pretty big. It's pretty robust and strong in my life by this point. It's a lot harder to kill it. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. Now, we can look at that in the literal separation from God sense. But what if James is also telling us, but when we give this foothold to this thing and it starts to grow into a way of life, it can kill who we could have been. And I allow the one night stand with whatever it is to become a way of life that in the end steals the life that I could have had from me, and I never get the life I could have had in the life God wanted for me. And I think we need all kinds of caution decals over that.